we talk about the master's tools, we talk about things like words, education, opportunity, money. Sorry, I'm not giving those up. In fact, you know what? Those resources belonged to people of color. Those resources belong to women. Those resources, they're not the master's tools. He just stamped his damn name on them. I'm taking them fucking back, erasing the name, and pretending that that never happened.
Awesome.
I was like, sure, I won't use the master's tools. You find me something he actually made, and I won't use it.
That's a good point. My name is Nia King. Today, I have the great pleasure of sitting down and speaking with Rika Aoki, who is an artist, activist, writer, just published a book called Seasonal Velocities, which you should definitely check out, available from Transgenre Press. Trans-genre.com is their website. And she's up for a Lambda Literary Book Award. In addition to her work being amazing, she's just an incredibly inspiring person. I'm super inspired by everyone that I've talked to so far on the podcast, but I like almost cried during this interview. Like, not quite, but I was definitely having a lot of feels going on during this conversation. I was just really moved by her big-heartedness and just sort of like peaceful acceptance of not the way things are, because obviously she's an activist for change, but that sort of peace with the world, for lack of a better way to put it. This was my first guerrilla interview, which was held in an empty conference room at the San Leandro Library, unbeknownst to the staff there. Fortunately, we did not get kicked out. We were originally going to meet up in a little coffee shop, but it was too loud to record audio, so we snuck into the library and found an empty room and had this conversation, which you're about to hear, and I hope that you will enjoy. Without further ado, here's Rika.
An entire book depended on a handout. Everything there was done by trans people, gender variant people, anyone who touched anything creatively with that book, from layout to cover. That entire press is completely trans run, and we had no outside help. We just put it together, and I found a publisher who actually AJ Bryce, who is the publisher. He was actually doing a record company kind of label web presence, and he had wanted to do become a publisher, rather. And so we said, okay, let's link dreams. And you work your ass off, I work my ass off, and we find people who believe in our dream, and let's go forward. And so back to the Lambda Literary, I find that we were recognized and became nominated for a final. Just an amazing victory, just to me, in my eyes, for grassroots organizing. Yeah. It's a beautiful book. I mean, I just love the cover. The cover was painted by, you know, an old school person who went around, Jack Dandy, who considers themselves butch, but comes from a generation where trans men really wasn't the same kind of option that it was, and the identities get kind of played around. And so this, every page of that book, there's to me something in it that I could tell a story about. Cover's beautiful. AJ squiggled lines all over the thing. I took chances with that book that I would have never taken with a straight publisher or a cisgendered publisher. Sorry, you know, that wouldn't have done with Allison Books would never have published that. So, yeah. So even, you know, it's an honor to be nominated. There are some great, great nominees that I'm sharing this with. I hope I win. I hope we win. But I think we already did.
That's a great way to look at it. How do you even get on the radar of Lambda Literary when you're like a small press that has maybe never published a book before? Was this the first book that Transgenre did?
Absolutely. And so far, it's still the only one. We have other books coming up, but we'll talk more about that later. You know, Kit Yan, Shauna Virago, James Terry. Okay. So you get on the radar by pulling strings. You get on the radar by going to other people's events and learning. When somebody offers you a reading at times and, you know, you're tired, you take the reading. You take an interview, you know, the morning after a show, like we're doing here. Also, you talk later on about, you know, if we talk about higher education, I've got an MFA. Mm-hmm. Having letters behind my name really, really helps matters. It opens doors. You know, whether or not you think an MFA is a worthwhile thing as your growth as an artist, it sure as heck opens doors. You know, not everybody who decides who gets the publishing deal is a writer. Some of them are bean counters. Some of them are administrators. And they respect, for some odd reason, they sometimes respect that. And like it or not, that's kind of the game. You know, just kind of like it or not. If you're going to be successful in this country, sooner or later, you have to deal with a white man. I mean, you just have to. Sorry, you know, you might be working at the bank. You know, it's like, you may not want it to be this way, but it is.
Yeah.
So I would just say, you know, if we're doing that, just really to get some attention from Lambda, it's just really make a lot of friends and be genuine friends to them. And I think if you put into the community, I may be naive, but if you put into the community gives back.
You're talking a little bit about having an MFA and the sort of legitimacy that that lends you. I think, so I interviewed recently Dr. Courtney Ryan Zabler.
Cool.
Yeah, and we had a long talk about, you know, their handle is Blackademic, and sort of like the experience of being a person of color in higher education and sort of the costs and benefits of like, I recently got into grad school for MFA program in cinema, and I'm trying to figure out if I'm going to go. I'm going to try not to turn this into my personal college counseling session.
Right ahead.
But I think sometimes it's hard to determine what the value of something like an MFA...
Higher education will help you realize your dreams. No, just
Or a PhD, because it seems like a lot of times queer and trans folks of color really struggle in those spaces of higher education. And sometimes, and with all the things you hear about how degrees don't take you as far as they used to these days, you know, you have all these people either underemployed or unemployed working jobs that they're way overqualified for. I think sometimes it's hard to know whether it's a worthwhile investment to pursue higher education. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, it's really, right now, especially for queer folk, you know. Well, you know, there's two different types of queer folk. I mean, let's just come right out and say that, you know, there's some people who, you know, you have kind of your well-heeled folks who come out as queer in college and things like that, but, you know, they still come from a bit of money. I'm not going to really talk about them because, you know, they got their financial advisors, you know, and they may have their own family dynamic, but I didn't grow up rich. Mm. So I can't speak to that experience. I don't know. But, you know, if you're kind of putting yourself through school, I still believe in the MFA, provided you're dedicated. I shouldn't say good. Good is... what does that mean, right? Provided you're willing to work. Provided you're willing to stay in when all your friends are out partying. Provided you get up in the morning because you can't stay away from your pen. Provided you can see yourself doing nothing else in the world but write. Then the MFA is an amazing thing. And I would say the same thing for cinema. Mm-hmm. If that is what you are born to do, then the MFA helps immensely. You have contacts. You you make friends. You learn techniques. Actually, you still go to school and learn. I didn't know what so many poetic forms were. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize the publishing game. And so you actually learn stuff in school. You still learn shit in school. It's just the most amazing thing. If you're going there, though, just to put off the real world, you know, if you're really tied, you know, to, if you're really worried about the real world, you're thinking grad school's going to, it doesn't work that way anymore. The other one, too, is if you're really tied in street-level community work, and that's where you want to be, and you want to work at the community, you want to work at a community center, and you want to build your life that way, then perhaps leaving school will break, you know, leaving the community for school will break your heart. I've seen that happen. I saw people at Cornell where I did my MFA. They dropped out of the program because they couldn't bear to be outside of their community where they knew there had been so much, you know, work for them to do. So I guess it's, I mean, this answer is kind of a non-answer. If you know you belong in an MFA program, an MFA program will still help you. If you have any doubts, though, an MFA and a PhD, these programs, they cost a lot of money. And just like anything else, it costs a lot of money. I mean, really, you know, cost of getting a PhD. I mean, do you want the PhD or do you want the Rolls Royce? It's amazing how much money that just goes down.
Yeah. Sorry, there's something you said I want to follow up on, and I'm trying to remember what it is. You're a writing teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you teach people how to write? I've always wondered if that's...
Well, there's a difference between teaching people how to write.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky. There's a difference between painting this wall and painting the Sistine Chapel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I try to shy away from teaching creative writing classes. I feel a poet or a short story writer or something, they'll find their way. I'm proud to teach composition courses. I teach housewives, and I teach kids who just, who maybe have never been told that they could write and are intimidated by writing. A lot of my students are students of color, and you know, they just feel that they don't have ownership of the English language, and that will cripple them. You know, grad school or not, that just destroys them. You know, what's the difference? I tell my students, what's the difference between I work hard and I works hard? You know, $20 an hour. So when I teach writing, I teach it as there's nothing different from teaching writing as there is any sort of construction. It's a system. You do your free writing. You do your outlining. You give yourself time to think and to breathe. And, you know, there is such a thing as subject-verb agreement, and there is such a thing as a topic sentence. And here's how a topic sentence works if you put it at the front of the paragraph or the back of the paragraph. And the way I teach them is it's simply another process. If you are, you know, no different from unplugging a sink or from changing the oil in a car or for coloring someone's hair or for, you know, cooking dinner for your family, if you can nail it down to process, it's not so intimidating.
And once someone has like a, you know, sort of a mastery of the English language, how do you help them become a better writer?
At that point, I've given them, once I teach them the mechanics, and here's hoping I teach the mechanics, my job as teacher is over, because at that point I've given them skills. Go live your life. I mean, I'm your auto mechanic. I don't tell you where to drive. You know, I taught you how to cook. I'm not going to tell you what to cook. I'll make recommendations, and I feel blessed that some of my students come back to me to ask for advice. But at that particular point, the only thing I tell them is read. Just read. Just, you know, be a contributing member to the English language. Read, enjoy, borrow, steal, write, you know, just learn. And a few of them, I think, have caught on over the years. And for those, I'm really, really grateful.
Oh, I remember what I was going to ask you, please.
If you've noticed, I'm long-winded. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no, no. That's what interviews are made of. If all your answers were short, there would be nothing to air.
Yeah. So what?
I'm just kidding. You were talking about folks that go to grad school who really, that, like, takes them out of their community, and their community is kind of their lifeblood. I feel like we still have a ways to go in terms of starting to see organizing and art as, like, really intricately related, and not having art be something that takes you away from organizing, or organizing being something that takes you away from art. I feel like artists like Fabiana Rodriguez and Melanie Cervantes are starting to help bridge that gap. But what do you think is, I guess, the ideal, like, what does it look like to be an artist who's still involved in community on a street sort of level?
Mm. Well,
involved in organizing on that level.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I have been given a few, I've been blessed with a few set of tests, few talents, and I know what I'm good at, and I know things that I'm not very good at. You know, no queer is an island. And I write, I can take something and, you know, make it sound a little bit better than it used to be. I don't know sometimes where those words come from, but they're there. That is my passion. I think that I depend heavily on the greater community for everyone to kind of do what they do best. A lot of these great community organizers are terrible dancers. I've seen them. I think what I mean by that is, what does it really mean to be an organizer? What really the hell does that mean?
I often feel like I have no idea. I've been asked that at job interviews, and I just have to make something up.
You know, I mean, yeah, what are you organizing? What, you know, when we talk about organizing, when I tell my students to organize a paper, you have the thesis first, and then you organize according to the thesis. What is the thesis of all this organization? What are we all trying to do? And I think that the artists and the, you know, work, you know, the artists, the writers, the movie makers, I think that they provide a lot of thought on that level as well. You know, it's like, what are we doing here? Because it's really too easy to see what we do, a succession of battles in the trenches, battles in the trenches, battles in the trenches, and then there's infighting. I don't know if you know this, but, you know, sometimes queers fight each other. I know, big, you know, big surprise, right?
I'm well aware.
And I really think that's wasted effort. And I think a lot of that comes from, just in my humble opinion, people thinking they have to sacrifice some of who they are for the greater cause.
Yeah.
Look, I'm a femme. I want it all, baby. You know, so I mean, it's like, why can't I be a poet and have my poetry change the world? Why can't you be a filmmaker and have your films change the world? Why can't somebody else be an accountant and have their accounting change the world? You know, why can't somebody else have, you know, organize a sit-in and have the sit-in change the world? All of these together, I think, create that healthier community. We talk about what an organ is, you know. The heart isn't busy breathing. The heart's pumping blood. The kidneys aren't thinking. That's what the brain does. The brain, you know, isn't processing air. That's what the lungs do, you know. And if we just kind of respect each other and just trust that we're all doing our job and are happy doing our job, our passion, I'd be for that.
Yeah. So you started out as a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
How did you become interested in poetry?
Well, I was always interested in poetry, but I used to be, still am. I think it's time I come out. I'm Asian. And I'm significantly older than you are. And there was a time when there weren't very many Asian American writers.
Mm.
And I got not so gently shoved into the sciences. I mean, I scored pretty highly on some of those tests. I mean, I'm good at it, but I got shoved in there. I kind of got profiled. And I would take chemist. I would, if you looked at my notebooks from college, the chemistry notes would be going right to left. And then if you go left to right, you see poetry coming in. So I've always wanted to do poetry, but, you know, I think I bowed to a little bit of the pressure to be secure at first in my life, to do the safe thing, and it did not work out.
How do you overcome that pressure?
You almost commit suicide.
I've been thinking a lot lately about how, I mean, this is going to be a little depressing, but I guess since we're talking about suicide, we can go there. You know, as I'm interviewing all these super amazing artists and activists and people that just really inspire me and are so creative and work so hard, a lot of them are broke. Like, a lot of them are really struggling. And it's just made me think a lot about, like, how do you decide to become an artist when you kind of know that you're never going to make any money?
Well,
or is it a decision?
I think that, yes, it is a decision. You say, in fact, I think it has to be a decision. Where, you know, it's like being in a relationship where, you know, if you fall into the relationship and never quite commit to it, that's completely different than looking at your partner and saying, we in this together? Yeah, we're in this together. Really? Forever? Well, you know, whatever forever means to queers, but yes. And there comes that time, you know, when you're in the kitchen cooking and you've got all these options to cook because you just got, you know, sooner or later you've got to say, you have to say, look, I'm making the lentil beans. And I know I've got some other stuff back there, but if I keep thinking what I'm going to make, I'm never cooking. In the same way, you have to commit to being a writer or an artist. You have to say, no more safety net.
But I guess my question is, like, how do you let go of the fear of not being able to survive?
You don't let go of it. You channel it and you let that fear drive you. Every time that you're afraid, you work harder. You wake up an hour earlier. You don't go out that extra day. You make that email to that person who could help you. You smile. You use that time to think about all the amount of work you need to do. It's weird when you have that kind of dedication. Internally, your self-talk gets a lot easier to deal with. But yeah, you don't get away from the fear. You turn the fear around, and you let that sucker put you forward.
You think most art is driven by fear?
I think that most art is driven by whatever emotion they can use. Mm-hmm. Art is omnivorous. I think that I get afraid. I feel that it's important that we be able to channel all emotions. I know artists who are only channeled by hate or who are only channeled by happiness. And, you know, you just, what happens if there's nothing more to hate?
It'd be a good world, I guess.
I guess. But, you know, think about, you know, these rock musicians, you know, who spend their entire lives, not just musicians, but people who spend their entire lives as other. And then when they finally get some measure of acclaim, they can't deal with it. It's like, what the hell? I'm successful. Where the hell do I go now? Their work starts to change, and sometimes not in a good way. I think of myself as, I try to position myself as an omnivore. If I'm happy, I'm going to write about that. If I'm sad, I'm going to channel that. If I'm pissed off, I'm going to channel that. And so fear is just another one.
Yeah. Is that, you know, you're talking about channeling these different emotions. Is that part of why, I haven't read your new book yet, but I read a review of it, and they talked about the sort of, I know your press is called transgenre, but the book sounds like it really is transgenre in terms of the different types of writing that's in there.
Very much so. Seasonal velocities, yeah, it does cover, and I divided it according to seasons, you know, starting with winter going through fall. And each season does have it's almost as if I am drawing from a different emotion coming through. And also, I tend to channel different emotions in different ways. And so that's why when you say it is transgenre, there are essays in there, there are poems in there, there are a couple performance pieces in there, there are, you know, there's a song in there, actually, too. And all of these contribute to this collage. And so it is very much a mixed genre book. What I tried to, when you do a mixed genre book, you have to be really, really careful, because it so easily can just literally be kind of this pastiche, just a collage of just stuff. So the seasons are such to me a primal and you know, inevitable way to organize time. So winter, spring, summer, fall, very, very, very good. And then within each chapter, I tried to think about the American musical, where it, how, you know, songs give emotion to the dialogue, which contextualizes the music and so on and so forth. And I wanted to make sure that all my pieces held that way. And I don't know if they have or not. I've done my best. Some people seem to think so, and I'm grateful for them.
Yeah. Do you feel like pulling from different genres, or like having a sort of diverse array of mediums that you draw from, is a political choice?
I think it's a political artifact. I think that I can't, you know, be like Wallace Stevens and go, you know, sit in an office somewhere and write poetry for the rest of my life. I can't, you know, I don't have a job in the poetry department. That's not what I do. There are some times when the immediacy of something, it's like, I don't have time to waste with a metaphor. I'm here, I'm going to give you an essay. Or, you know, this is a story because, you know, I just need to tell it the way it came at me. Or, and then sometimes, you know, here's a poem because I really, really need to take the time out to break your heart. And, but in each one of those, you notice it starts with, I need, I need, I need. And the need, the artistic need. And I think if success had come to me earlier on, in other words, if I hadn't had been, you know, one of the few people of color in the in my MFA program, or if I hadn't been queer, hadn't been trans, maybe success might have come to me a little differently, a little more early, and I would have found myself ensconced in some poetry department somewhere. And at that point, my essays would have seemed more like excursions as opposed to expressions. And so I think part of what we're seeing when so many queer and marginalized people do so many things, it's a bit of a blessing, but I do think it's an artifact of oppression.
Yeah. I took a couple of writing classes at Mills, and both the classes I took in, I was like one of, I think, two people of color in the class, which I imagine is probably not uncommon, but it, a lot of my writing is about race, and that made it really hard to talk about race in class. And I think also, not made it hard for me, but I felt like the feedback that I got was, like, people had a hard time engaging with what I was actually saying. Well, is that something that you encountered?
Absolutely. At the Cornell program, I was maybe the second Asian American in the entire program ever. You know, definitely the, you know, just, and so I would, and at the time, we did our copying at the copy center. The people at the copy center, when I was trying to print handouts for the class I was TA, didn't believe I was part of the English department.
Wow.
And I had to get one of my white friends to vouch for me that I was part of the English department.
This is when?
This is in the late 80s. Yeah, I'm that old, but still, yeah, not too long ago. You know, when you think about the grand scheme of things. And actually, it was like the early 90s, God, whew, yeah. And then when I talked about race, you know, people are saying, you know, or just when I talked about myself, it's like, why do you keep bringing race into things? And I'm not bringing race into things. Can't you see I'm talking about my grandpa or my grandma or my breakfast? And I'm sorry that, you know, I'm eating rice for breakfast, but I'm not bringing race into it. This is breakfast to me. And it can, that part of the MFA experience sucks ass, okay? Where you don't get, you know, where you don't, your cohort just doesn't get it. They can be supportive in so many other ways, but there's these areas where they can't. And that's, I guess, where you just got to think, I'm in it for myself. You know, I'm here to improve as a writer. to create contacts, to make community. But in the end, my writing is beholden to me. I hope that helps a little.
Yeah. One of my friends that I interviewed, it's not up on the internet because it was sort of a practice interview before I started the podcast, but she's a transgender sculptor, and she was talking about in art school just not being able to get useful feedback or like critique on her work at all, so she would just bring friends to her crits so that she could actually get like useful feedback. Did you have any sort of like creative workarounds like that?
Well, what I learned to do early on, because I didn't have friends to do that with, I didn't get much support going into the program, but I think part of the reason was at that particular point in time I'd been working as a chemist, so most of my friends didn't understand why I would give up this really, you know, solid job analyzing toxic waste to go, you know, write poetry. Why on earth would you ever write poetry when, you know, you can, you know, put brown liquid from a sump into a machine? Oh boy. So oh my god, there was one time at chemistry, totally different thing, where we had oil from a crematorium, and I had to like analyze flash points. I'm like making human oil ignite, and I'm just thinking, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way. This oil came from a human being. I can make soap. So oh god. So anyway, what the hell were we talking about?
I was asking you if you had creative workarounds for the sort of like not being able to get the kind of feedback that would be helpful on your work.
I think my experience as an abuse victim really helped, because, you know, you learn what you can and can't expect from your parents. You know, you're not ever going to expect unconditional love. That just is never going to happen. So you're grateful for the food. You are grateful for the good times, and you kind of gear up for the bad times. You understand that the shit can hit any time, any place without warning, so you hoard. So I learned how to do that. So when I was in my MFA program, when I learned quickly that these people actually had something that I valued, consistency, I knew what kind of criticism I could get. So when they talked about my imagery of, you know, I would listen. When they talked about meter, I would listen. When they talked about different forms and other writers I should think about reading, I would listen. But then when they started telling me that, you know, I was bringing race up, I would turn it off.
Yeah, that's really smart.
it's wisdom that came from, yeah, it's like that wisdom came at a price.
So we talked a little bit about your background as a chemist making human oil.
You didn't make the human oil. It showed up in a jar.
Such a visual image that I'm hopping not to leave this
room.
There
was this other thing when there was like this other one. There was this, and I didn't always do forensics, but occasionally there'd be like this water that came from a drowning victim. When I'm shaking this jar, thinking this is the last person, that's the last thing she ever saw.
Oh my god!
It's like,
what
gross.
Was your job?
I was an environmental chemist, and okay. So a lot of the stuff, the forensics had already passed. But now, how do we dispose of this stuff?
Huh.
You ever think about that? You know, once something is over, is it toxic or is it that kind of thing? So we used to analyze all kinds of things. We used to analyze that. But sometimes we get really good stuff. Like, you know, one time we had to, like, analyze alcohol content for beer, and so we all got free beer. So it's not always gross stuff.
That is a more positive note to end that on. But you're also a master martial artist.
Uh-huh.
What kind of martial arts?
Judo. Judo, although right now I'm teaching a more inclusive form of self-defense. But my background training is judo.
That's cool. I always thought judo was really interesting because, I hope I'm not wrong about this, I'm not an expert, but you like use your opponent's force against them. And so
absolutely.
It's sort of considered like a soft form,
mm-hmm.
in that there's not a lot of like striking.
No striking in tournament judo whatsoever. And I really enjoy judo simply because it's almost like having a conversation where, you know, you're just working and, you know, you're just trying to come to... I tell my students, you don't beat your opponent, you become one with your opponent, and then you master yourself.
That's deep.
So, you know, when I'm in a judo match, it's almost like having a conversation and trying to get my other half to agree with me.
Mm-hmm. Does that sort of impact or affect the way that you sort of look at your social justice work, or?
How could I not? I've been doing judo since I was 10, and you know, I was this small little Asian kid who was a bit of a bookish geek, and you know, skipped a grade and was small anyway. And when I started doing judo, by the time I got to green belt, for some reason people started leaving me alone.
And how old were you then?
I was like 12, middle school, which is a good time to be left alone.
And green belt is like how high up is that in the rankings?
Like 2 or 3 up, you know. Okay. It's like, yeah, it's all good, you know. But at the time, I didn't really, you know, I thought I would have to fight. I thought I'd have to go, hey, you know, wax on, wax off, bitch. But it really just turned out that maybe it was the way I was carrying myself or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of how it informs, yeah. You know, whenever there's a fight, there are two types of fighters. The type who want to show the world that they can fight, and the type who want to win. And, you know, I'm not in there. I don't really want people to know I can fight, you know, which is why I'm telling you I'm a 5th-degree black belt in a podcast. But still, this was for education purposes only, kind of like, you know, a dildo in South Carolina. It's for novelty purposes only. you know, I just want to, the best way for me to win an argument or a fight or a political battle is to make the other person think they thought of it first.
Like Inception style.
Yes, it's just to maneuver, and then when the person thinks he's thought of it, he has thought of it first, he then pursues it with his own passion. And so then what I'm actually doing is literally using his own force against him.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I think, you know, there are different approaches to social justice, and a lot of people feel like anger is a really important, useful tool, and that combat is sort of like how social justice manifests itself. But it sounds like you have a very different approach. Or maybe this is combat and it just looks very different.
It's teaching. I don't see myself as a warrior. I see myself as a teacher. And when there's somebody who is my adversary, I don't think of that person as an obstacle. I think of that person as a learning experience. I'm going to sometimes be the student. I'm going to sometimes be the teacher. But we're going to get through this, and we're each going to become wiser for the encounter. And it kind of works, you know. I'm not a fighter. I love learning. I love teaching. Why can't we use that and have social justice as a way where there doesn't have to be a winner or a loser, where we all become more aware?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you're describing utopia.
Yeah, but you know, the person who says we're going to kill all our enemies, so we're going to be the only ones who are strong and we're going to take justice back, really, is that any more realistic?
I mean, I don't know if that's justice.
That's not justice. That's
even
just,
related.
You know, but you know, when you hear the people, we've got to struggle against the man. I mean, to me, that's purgatory. Hmm. You're going to spend the rest of your life struggling against the man. You dream of purgatory. I'll dream of utopia, and together we're still going to work with each other. I'm not going to invalidate you. It's just I can't see where you're coming from, and you can't see where I'm coming from. But you know what? You know, the heart can't see the brain, but they work together.
Yeah, I really admire and kind of envy your like wisdom and how like at peace with all of this you seem. I don't know.
I love what I do. I love to write. I love my teaching. I love, you know, it's like I teach on my birthday sometimes, and I tell my students, my birthday wish for all of you is to have a job that you love enough that you want to come on your birthday and go do it.
Yeah. I'm like getting emotional. No, that's really sweet. You just have such an amazing spirit of like kindness and generosity, and I think it's hard to maintain that. I think social justice, like being involved in that struggle, makes a lot of people jaded and bitter, and I include myself in that, and you just don't seem to have any of that at all.
No, I you know, it's like every day I can look out and see that tree and just see how beautiful the light is off of that. I win.
Yeah, I feel like I look at that window and I see the American flag and think about war and nationalism. And
yeah, and you know, sometimes it's good to see the symbols, sometimes it's good to see the colors, and you know, just, you know, in terms of being, the funny thing about being jaded is that people think that's the end state. You start from innocent and you become jaded. Nah. It's like being a butterfly. You start, you know, it looks like, you know, you look at the monarch butterfly, right? And it looks like it's jaded, right? But actually what's going on in there under the hard shell is there's a transformation. And I think that if you just stay with the process, eventually you just realize this sort of quote-unquote jaded covering is simply holding your wings back. Break through it. You'll be fine.
Yeah. I feel like that's a good place to wrap. Unless there's anything else that you'd like to share about yourself or your work.
Well, I mean, just that Seasonal Velocities comes from Transgenre Press, transgenre.net. And
there's a dash in there too.
Trans-genre.net. Thank you. Yes, trans-genre.net. And my own website is www.rykaryka.com. That's rykaryka.com. And yeah, I've got a bit of good news. I just signed a book deal with Topside, so my first novel is going to be coming out as well.
And what kind of press are they?
They started off as a trans press.
Oh,
but
awesome.
This particular book that I wrote, Tom Leger in New York, in Brooklyn, he's doing some amazing work himself. But my book that's coming out really has nothing too much to do with trans issues. It's pretty much a story of, you know, based on my family, you know, and I wasn't out as trans at the time. So there it is. But he's putting it on his Topside signature label because he believes in the book. And I'm going to just kind of, I know you wanted to end, but I just want to say this.
No, go ahead.
I was at a book panel, Rainbow Book Fair, and I broke down crying on the panel. I mean, not like little tears, but that kind of crying, because I was talking about this novel. It's called A Hilo Song, that's coming out, and it was about Hilo and dancing and how...
what is Hilo?
Hilo's a city in Hawaii.
Okay.
And it's on the Big Island, and you know, my grandfather's side of the family's there. Many of my best memories come from there. I wrote this novel about this, and it's one of the, to me, it's the best thing I've ever written, just flat out, period. I mean, I just put everything I had in that book. And but there's no trans characters. There's a couple gay characters, but they're very peripheral. And we're talking about trans press and trans narratives, and all of a sudden I said, you know, This world keeps telling me that I'm more than trans, that I'm a, you know, that I'm an artist, that I'm a, you know, that you're, they're working for, you know, that everyone's working for me to be a complete human being, and blah blah blah. And here I've got this novel that I just think is the most beautiful thing. And you know, a couple of my friends have read it, and they think it's a great novel too. But since it's not overtly queer, the very presses that are supposed to support me won't touch this. And you know, then I start crying, going, you know, it's like you say that you say you want me to be complete, but then when I'm writing these things, I've got to rip my heart in half. You know, what's going on? And I think we're at an exciting time right now where people like Tom, who's, you know, just a happy trans guy, kind of realize that in order for this community to grow, we have to not only grow as organizers looking for useful things to keep furthering the queer and trans agenda, but also nurturing our artists. And, you know, who are also furthering the queer and trans agenda, albeit in a different way. Every book I write is trans. I love that. It's great. But if we expect our trans people to be more than professional trans people. We have to let them be professional chefs and professional doctors. And you know what? When I have my neurologist taking care of my brain, and, you know, Z is a trans or genderqueer person, I don't want that person thinking about, you know, here, identity. I want that person thinking about my brain. Because, you know, when I, you know, it's like I want, you know, a trans pilot on a jetliner. I don't want that person thinking about trans identity. I want that person piloting the jet. And when I'm writing, I want people to welcome my writing, my craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that brings up an interesting point.
I know you're probably going to edit this. Sorry, you guys.
That's my job. Don't worry about it. I'm going to drop another name. I interviewed La Chica Boom recently, and we got into, after the interview was over, we got into an interesting conversation about the idea of being pigeonholed as like an X artist or a Y artist. And I think in part it came from this workshop I went to recently where people were supposed to get together and talk about race and queerness in the arts. And people were coming from really different places. There were, you know, there was someone who's like, I'm not gonna check the Asian box or the queer box to get money. Like, I'm just an artist, and if you can't, like, deal with it, then that's your problem. You know, if you're trying to squish me into a box. And I've just been thinking a lot about whether sort of being a queer and or racialized artist is an asset or a liability, because I think in some ways it opens a lot of doors. You know, like when Black History Month comes around, a lot of Black artists have a chance to show work and make money that maybe they don't the rest of the year, or at least not as much. But at the same time, there's also, if you're not making work about race or about queerness and you're getting, you know, you're only getting a chance to perform at the Black shows or whatever, then like, what does that mean? I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. I realize it's not exactly a question.
Well, for me, rule number one is, and because I've already thought about this, it makes it a little easier. You know, when the white man gives you money, take the money and run. You know, you just won. You know, it's like, great. You know, it's like, so you had to check off that you're Asian. You know, you get to pay rent. That's cool. You can do a lot of things with a roof over your head. In terms of being pigeonholed, you know, what helps get me out of pigeonholes are the backdoor dealings, are kind of like talking to people, maybe seeing the person in the other part of the audience going, hey, you know, I saw you came to my show or my reading, and you start to go to other people's readings and you start to say, and it's kind of, I think sometimes if one gets pigeonholed on stage, there's no pigeonholing off stage. One can go to whatever show they want, usually, especially on the West Coast. And I just find that being nice, really trying to listen to the work, you know, that, you know, if you're in a show that, if you watch a show that maybe you don't feel welcome being a part of, but you admire the work for real, you listen to it, you enjoy it, you have honest questions about it and curiosity, and then you start talking to the people and you start learning a little bit. And instead of breaking the walls down, you look for the door.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it may take a while, but I think at that particular point, I don't handle anger very well. And it's easier for me to believe that other people are ultimately, if you find the right way in, most people are not assholes.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to wrap on to.